Americans lived. Even when the modest starting salary was not an obstacle for prospective hires, OTS faced other special problems in recruiting. Because of the classified nature of the work, CIA employees were prohibited from publishing papers or obtaining patents. By working for the CIA, they could be assured of earning less than in the private sector and receiving no professional prestige that would otherwise accompany publication or publicity of a technical breakthrough. The necessities of security demanded that their hard work, though frequently invaluable, would remain secret. Finally, they might never know how, where, or if their labors had paid off in field operations. Nevertheless, the agency found ways to tap America's engineering and scientific talent. The OSS model of collaborating with private companies that served America's intelligence effort well during World War II continued to provide TSS and OTS a window into leading-edge research. Eventually, this partnership model provided a decisive advantage over the centralized Soviet system, a fact not lost on some Soviet leaders. "We lack R&D and a manufacturing base," said Lavrenty Beria, head of the NKVD. "Everything relies on a single supplier, Elektrosila. The Americans have hundreds of companies with large manufacturing facilities." The Soviet Union, by contrast, handled its need for engineering talent decidedly differently. Its engineers, scientists, and mathematicians, who showed particular brilliance or promise, were singled out and channeled into advanced studies. If they measured up, they were put to work in intelligence, the most talented sometimes held as virtual captives in KGB-controlled Sharashka, prison labs. From such facilities, the Thing, along with some of the Soviet Union's most advanced weaponry, aircraft, and rocket technology, including early nuclear devices, emerged. Russian aircraft designer A.N. Tupolev was held in one such prison in Bolshevo, outside Moscow, as was the physicist P.L. Kapitsa. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, in his book The First Circle, immortalized his own experiences in the Sharaska known as the O-1 Institute, which coincidentally also held Leon Theremin, inventor of the Thing. The Soviet scientists were left with little choice as to where to apply their talents. "Leave them in peace," Stalin was reputed to have said of the imprisoned scientists. "We can always shoot them later." However, if Beria imagined all of America's industrial technology focused on defense or intelligence, he was mistaken. Post-World War II industry was largely geared for profit in consumer or industrial markets, and the trick, OTS discovered, was in adapting the innovative commercial and military technologies to clandestine use. TSD's inventiveness encompassed aircraft as well as listening devices. The North Korean seizure of the USS Pueblo in January of 1968 became the backdrop to one of its most ambitious aviation projects. One of the frustrations facing both the Johnson and Nixon administrations was the seemingly limited options available to avenge such incidents short of declaring war. Responding to the White House, in the spring of 1970, TSD was tasked to develop a means to infiltrate intelligence or paramilitary teams into hostile or otherwise inaccessible areas. The project got started because of comments attributed to Nixon's national security advisor, Henry Kissinger, recalled one of the principal officers. "We understood he wanted a covert capability to access strategic North Korean targets if we ever decided to attack and destroy them." Because the likely military or economic targets would be accessible only by air, a silent aircraft operating at night could potentially reach the targets covertly, thereby hiding the U.S. government's hand in the operation. From an intelligence perspective, such an aircraft could have the additional capabilities for deploying covert sensors for intelligence collection and conducting hostage rescue missions. The initial requirement called for an aircraft that could fly 1,000 miles without refueling and carry a two-man team along with a modest 150-pound payload. Primarily because of its range, the Hughes OH-6 helicopter was identified as the platform for the project. OTS acquired an off-the-shelf OH-6 and went to work reducing its operating noise. "First, we slowed the tip speed down on the main rotor," said Jack Knight, the TSD officer who headed the project. That required we change the rotor, so we made a five-blade version rather than four to get the same lift pattern. We could move the same amount of air at a lower RPM and maintain the same lift. We also changed out the tail rotor, going from two blades to four. The engine noise presented a different set of problems. An initial attempt with a muffler failed when a contractor designed one weighing nearly 400 pounds, far too heavy for the OH-6. However, Knight had heard that a commercial aircraft manufacturer was running a program to quiet its jet aircraft and paid the company a visit. There was a guy working on a quieting program for a long-haul passenger plane, and we went to talk to him, said Knight. We asked to borrow him for a few months, but the company had other plans for him, so that was a disappointment. But on the way out the door, he handed me a business card with his home number written on the back. I called that night, and he said he'd work on the project during his off hours. He eventually designed an engine quieting system that weighed about 30 pounds, a perfect fit for us. What the engineer did, explained Knight, was identify the sound frequencies coming from the engine making the most noise and attack them by creating a series of sophisticated acoustic chambers. Just as high-end audio speakers are designed internally to acoustically enhance certain frequencies, the engineer's design performed the opposite function, trapping the sound waves in a carefully constructed series of baffles. With the rotors and engine silenced, or at least quieted, Knight and his team next targeted the noises coming from the chopper's other moving parts. First, the transmission was quieted, and then they turned their attention to the converters, small generators, that provided auxiliary power, which were found to be extremely noisy. Their studies eventually led to converting the OH-6 over to solid-state electronics that required less power and smaller, quieter generators. Then all of a sudden we found a real noisy valve in the fuel control system, remembered Knight. You never hear it in a normal helicopter, but it was a screamer. I took it back to the manufacturer and told them to quiet it down. They looked at me like I was a nutcase. But they did it using silicone insets to cushion the moving parts. From start to finish, the project was completed and delivered in less than 2 months. The result was an OH-6, operating in quiet mode, that could not be heard on the ground as it passed over at 500 feet. Flying at the optimum quiet speed of 85 knots, the helicopter was less fuel efficient, while higher speeds increased the noise but improved fuel efficiency. Richard Helms, the DCI at the time, followed the progress of the silenced helicopter with great interest. He called Knight in for several briefings on the project as it moved through various stages, the conversations frequently focusing on the difference between quiet and silent. One day, Lawrence Houston, Helms's senior lawyer, called Knight. "I want to go to California and hear this thing," Houston stated. Knight obliged, taking Houston out to the Culver City airport late at night to stand in the center of a darkened runway. Knight ordered a flyby of a standard OH-6, which was audible from one end of the runway to the other. Houston and Knight stood on the runway tarmac as the sound faded and then vanished altogether. After a few minutes, Houston asked when the quiet helicopter would be coming. "It just did," Knight replied, and then radioed the pilot to make another pass and illuminate the helicopter when overhead. "That son of a bitch is quiet," Houston exclaimed. His report to Helms settled the question of quiet versus silent. The second major requirement for the quiet helicopter was a capability to see into the night. Knight and his TSD team needed a forward-looking infrared, FLIR, system that would allow night flights at low altitude. Knight discovered that the smallest system available weighed several hundred pounds and produced poorly defined images that often resembled blobs. In principle, infrared sees not the gradations of light like a video or still camera does, but differences in temperature. It picks up heat emanating from an object, much like a camera records light reflected from an object. At the time, FLIR was a new technology, somewhat comparable to early tintype photography during the Civil War. When Knight asked a military components company to help with the FLIR problem, two recently graduated electrical engineers, both in their mid-20s, were identified. Knight, listening to their ideas, did not leave the meeting until long after dark. With more enthusiasm than funding, the engineers saw in Knight and the agency the opportunity to put their theories into practice. The next morning, when Knight returned to the company, the FLIR manager was decidedly unfriendly. The manager sensed that the young engineers had committed the company to something that could not be delivered, and he did not want the corporate reputation riding on an impossible project. Knight countered by writing and signing a letter on the spot, absolving the company and the manager of any responsibility for the project's outcome. "I just wanted those kids, because I was convinced they could do something no one had done before," Knight recalled. "Those kids were going to run my program without interference from experienced naysayers." Within 60 days, the two engineers had an operating prototype of their system. What they had done was to rethink the way IR receivers processed signals. Typical IR systems processed long, mechanically scanned linear arrays that had wide variations in line-to-line sensitivity. The young engineers reconfigured existing technology to create a single array of 15 elements stacked together, which constituted a single point detector with the capability to scan in both the horizontal and vertical planes. The additional elements allowed the system to take in more information, which was then processed into a more detailed image. The result was sensitivity so high that the FLIR scanned at TV rates. "We told the engineers it couldn't weigh over 85 pounds, and they gave us one that weighed 15. We were getting recognizable images, not TV quality, but dang near," Knight said. "People couldn't believe the world they were seeing was through the eyes of a thermometer. It was so good, you could pick faces out just from the sensitivity that registered vein systems close to the surface of the skin. It was so startling, I think it killed every other FLIR program going on in the country at that point." Technology and the human agent were becoming interdependent as each gave the other capabilities and security that had previously not existed. Tiny, reliable, long-life audio devices could supplement an agent's information by remaining in a room after the agent departed. Small, concealable, low-light cameras enabled agents to clandestinely copy documents in supposedly secured areas. Low-power transmitters provided agents with a communications link to a handler he might never meet. As the complexity of the technology increased, so did the intricacies of hunting it out. Many of the companies that were once little more than Gene's garage shop contractors in the 50s and 60s had grown significantly by the 1970s, a few to multinational status. With their growth, some were no longer able or willing to accommodate the small production runs typical of clandestine equipment. The same problem Lovell faced in recruiting businesses into the specialized and marginally profitable field of intelligence 30 years earlier was now confronted by a new generation of agency managers. However, these managers ran into an obstacle not encountered by Lovell. The Cold War lacked the immediate urgency of World War II. Convincing a CEO to commit resources and manpower to clandestine endeavors with the inherent risk of exposure and adverse publicity became a tough sale. Although research funded by the agency sometimes gave companies a temporary lead in the marketplace, such as it had done with battery power saver technology, this ancillary benefit was never assured. In most instances, work for the CIA had limited practical application beyond espionage. In the early 1970s, OTS, in search of a digital device that pushed the limits of memory capacity, assessed the technology used for satellite-based reconnaissance that was moving toward digital imaging. The technology appeared to have clandestine applications. After receiving word that James Early was doing interesting work in the field at Fairchild Semiconductor, OTS sent Ford to investigate. Early, a member of the team that worked for Nobel Prize winner William Shockley on the transistor at Bell Labs, is frequently credited with pioneering efforts in moving the technology into commercial and industrial applications. By the time Ford stepped into Early's lab at Fairchild, the invention of the transistor was two decades in the past, and Early, a senior researcher, revered within the engineering and scientific communities. However, Ford found a scientist unwilling to rest on his laurels and showing unrestrained enthusiasm for pushing the limits of digital technology. I watched him work two blackboards on one side of the room for 45 damn minutes with more formulas than it took to build an A-bomb, said Ford. Finally, I said, "What's it going to take to build this thing?" The problem Ford faced was that OTS did not have a budget for theoretical research. Whatever funds were spent had to be committed to a specific device, so Ford instructed Early to build a camera. Early put the price at $25,000, with a completion date of 3 months. Ford gave him $50,000 and made a mental note the completion date would likely be closer to 9 years rather than 90 days. 3 months later, Early was in Ford's office setting up a contraption consisting of not much more than a small box with a 16mm lens mounted on one side and some wires trailing out from another to a picture tube and power supply. Ford watched as Early switched the device on and saw one of the first digital images captured by a charge-coupled device, CCD. The thing worked perfectly. I called a friend of mine over at the Advanced Research Projects Agency, ARPA, and said, "I don't know or care who you have in your office. Clear them out now," Ford recalled. Packing the device up and with his guest in tow, Ford set up a demonstration in an ARPA office a few miles away. The ARPA engineer recognized exactly what the impact of this was, Ford said. All he asked was, "How much money can they sensibly absorb?" CCD technology would, in fact, revolutionize traditional tradecraft, make real-time images from space platforms possible, and transform the camera business in the consumer market. An executive once asked me what was in the presentation that made me believe Early could pull this off, Ford remembered. I told him, "Nothing. The guy lost me after the first foot of formulas on the board. But I'm looking at this 60-something-year-old engineer, one of the co-inventors of the transistor, and he's jumping around like a 25-year-old kid. I'll give money to people like that." Another problem facing the agency was the nature of technological advancement itself. The speed at which technology progressed in the 3 decades after World War II placed OTS engineers in constant competition with consumer and industrial markets. "It's a race to get my device into the field before every other intelligence service has a countermeasure. Technology is my edge, so I have to get it into my clandestine product quickly," said one senior OTS scientist. For instance, until the mid-1980s, there were no cell phones, and you couldn't buy a walkie-talkie small enough to use covertly, so we had to build special stuff. Now anyone can buy most of the devices that we had to invent during the Cold War. The race against the consumer and industrial markets was one that OTS did not always win. Sometimes developments in the private sector either overtook agency engineers or shortened the operational life of a device to a surprising degree. In one notable case during the 1970s, OTS needed a better, more compact recording medium and contracted to have the standard size cassette shrunk down to allow for a smaller recorder. The contractor successfully delivered the device, but the effort was largely wasted when the first commercial and equally capable microcassette recorders appeared on the market a few months later. However, the overall trend of technological proliferation in the consumer marketplace also brought operational benefits. With the spread of small, affordable, portable devices, technology was becoming ubiquitous and transparent for people in every part of the world. For example, as Walkman headphones, along with low-priced pocket calculators, pagers, and digital watches, became common in the 1980s, these everyday products were adapted or disguised for clandestine use. Audio receivers, once hidden beneath lifelike molds of the user's ear, could now be disguised as headsets for music or a cell phone. Sometimes even standard commercial devices could be pressed into clandestine duty without modification. In an unwitting doctor's office in a European city during the 1980s, an answering machine, a new technology at the time, picked up calls in the middle of the night. Once or twice a month, a case officer would call the office, leave a brief message, and hang up. A short time later, An agent would call the office and tap in the code to access the messages on the answering machine. After retrieving instructions for a dead drop, he would then erase the secret message, leaving no trail back to his handler or even telephone records. One OTS scientist recalled a conversation with a case officer returning from Europe in the mid-1980s. The case officer offered details of something called a cellular phone. "I want to use this. You figure out how I can make covert calls," he told the scientist. As a result of the conversation, the scientist linked up with an operations officer with a technical bent and a senior engineer to figure out how to make early cell phone technology an operational tool. The inspiration the three-man team needed came from the criminal world. At the time, drug dealers in major cities were monitoring cell phone calls and hijacking the phones to ply their illegal trade. The team developed similar technology to snatch random caller codes out of the air in selected foreign countries, creating a covert phone system dubbed the portable payphone. Short-duration calls could be placed using a random number to sever any connection between the case officer and the agent. The borrowed number added only a few barely noticeable pennies to the phone bill of its unwitting owner. What's happened is that as technology kept getting more automated, it became smarter and adaptive, said the scientist. The more we could do, the more we're asked to do. New technologies let you do so many things you couldn't do before, but they also make our older equipment obsolete more quickly. Circuit boards and computer chips offered OTS miniaturization and flexibility for building equipment. Digital memory, a common component of modern electronic devices, became a blank slate upon which nearly anything could be written. Increasingly, even under close examination, spy gear was becoming indistinguishable from everyday objects. Digital tradecraft also advanced the concept of the cloaking function in electronic form, as generations of spies had done with concealments and dead drops, by creating spyware buried deep within lines of software code. The process known as convergence in the consumer marketplace, in which a cell phone stores music along with a datebook or text messaging function, would become the 21st century technical challenge for OTS. Section 5. Prison, Bullet, Passport, Bomb. Chapter 16. Conspicuous Fortitude, Exemplary Courage in a Cuban Jail. You are not expected to take anything with you in the field that would reveal your identity or in any way show that you are an agent of the government. U.S. Army order to an intelligence officer posted to Latin America in 1905. On September 8, 1960, three American businessmen stepped off a plane in Havana. The passports and tourist visas they presented to Cuban officials identified them as Daniel Carswell, age 42, an electrical engineer from Eastchester, New York, Eustace Van Brunt, 34, a mechanical engineer from Baltimore, Maryland, and Edmund Taransky, a 36-year-old electrical engineer from New York City. Along with their official travel documents, the three carried credit cards, driver's licenses, and other pieces of identification confirming their identities. However, their names and all the material that supported their identities were fictions. TSD artists skilled in document fabrication and reproduction had created all the mundane contents of their wallets, pocket litter, in CIA parlance. Eustace Van Brunt was TSD engineer Thornton Andy Anderson, while Edmund Taransky was really Walter Wally Zuminski, an audio tech. The third tourist, traveling as Daniel Carswell, was Dave Crist. The most senior of the three, Crist had recently become head of TSD's audio operations. In that capacity, Crist carried in his head worldwide knowledge of the CIA's bugging capabilities, equipment, targets, and current installations. Cloaked in their false identities and a cover story, the trio entered Cuba on a week-long mission to install clandestine listening devices. The target for the operation was not Cuban, but rather the future embassy of a critical hard-target country. This rare opportunity was the result of Cuba's decision to embrace diplomatically America's adversaries. The CIA learned where the embassy would be located and reached an agreement with the owner to allow agency techs access to plant the bugs. Not only was the chance to install listening devices in a major target a golden opportunity, the plan was virtually risk-free. The owner could authorize access to his building to anyone, even three American tourists, at any time. No one would ask questions. With open access to the building, the CRIST-led team planned to conduct a thorough pre-installation survey and then work without fear of interruption. The team's single concern lay with the Cuban government's growing antagonism and suspicion toward the United States. Since American tourism to the once popular Caribbean island was becoming increasingly rare, the arrival of three Yankee engineers in search of tropical fun could very well attract the attention of Castro's immigration or counterintelligence officials. While Cuba was still presenting a welcoming facade in the summer of 1960, unsettling changes were occurring under Castro's new government. During the 18 months following the revolution, Cuba's reputation as a Caribbean playground was in rapid decline. Refugees were streaming into Florida, while Havana increasingly became a city of civil unrest. Protests, which Castro aggressively countered with mass arrests, were becoming more common. Businessmen, who had supported the deposed dictator, General Fulgencio Batista, were branded as potential counter-revolutionaries and growing increasingly fearful of their new government. Despite these troubling developments, Castro's true political orientation was still uncertain. In power less than 2 years after seizing control on New Year's Day in 1959, he continued to deny communist leanings, although his 1960 decision to embrace the communist Chinese at the expense of the Taiwan government should have been taken as a good indication of where he was headed. America still maintained diplomatic ties with Castro's government, but relations were strained, and the situation between the two countries was clearly deteriorating. A conflict surrounding sugar imports to the United States, along with American condemnation of tightening government controls on Cuba's press, trade unions, and universities, angered Castro. Cuba had also resumed diplomatic relations with the Soviet Union, welcoming the new Russian ambassador, Sergei Kudryavtsev. 15 years earlier, Kudryavtsev had been declared persona non grata by the Canadian government after being linked to an extensive network of Soviet spies in that country. The Soviet Union now had a toehold in the Western Hemisphere, a friend in Castro, and a presence just 90 miles from the United States. From the U.S. perspective, the signals Castro sent out to the world in speeches and interviews were mixed. Human rights abuses were reported by Cuban refugees in Florida, and the Cuban leader's pledges not to nationalize businesses seemed hollow. In one of his odder pronouncements, Castro banned Santa Claus, along with the importation of Christmas trees in December 1959, bizarrely labeling both St. Nick and spruce trees as imperialistic. As formal rupture of relations between the two countries became more likely, the CIA began making stay-behind arrangements for intelligence activities on the island. Stocks of technical gear and espionage equipment were cached in the countryside. Agents who could no longer safely be met in person were given alternate communications plans and COVCOM systems, such as secret writing materials and maps to the cache sites. During the summer of 1960, CIA officers had spotted suspected surveillance by Cuban security officers, prompting the office in Havana to organize a small counter-surveillance team of recruited Cubans to protect its operations. At the same time, other elements of the CIA were already planning White House-approved covert operations against Cuba, including an armed invasion of the island by a refugee counter-revolutionary force and a possible assassination of the Cuban leader. The September audio operation took on urgency with the possibility that all official Americans could be ordered out of Cuba, rendering support for any technical attack virtually impossible. Already, a similar audio operation a month earlier against another target failed because of logistical problems. Adding to this growing list of concerns, September was midway through the hurricane season, and Hurricane Donna, forming in the Caribbean, threatened to disrupt travel to Cuba and upset operational timing. Given the circumstances, a delay of even a few days could see this opportunity slip away. A TSD team was needed to take advantage of a rapidly closing window of opportunity, but audio techs were in short supply. It was late summer, and some were on annual leave, others scattered in transit to new assignments, and ongoing operations consumed the remainder.